I wonder if there must be shows that like started off great with two co-hosts, you know, having a blast, and then something just went terribly wrong between them and they start up rival podcasts and they just talk crap about each other afterward.
Isn't that what happened with us in the future?
In the future. Yes. We're like laying the groundwork for this.
Welcome to the Maximize This podcast, the only podcast to dedicate its current episode to this past Saturday's annual Día del Amor y la Amistad.
I don't even know what that is. What is that?
In Colombia, they have a day every year where they celebrate love and friendship. The Day of Love and Friendship. And they spend a whole month leading up to it. Circles of friends do secret friend, like Secret Santa. And they leave little candies without telling the friend which friend they pick. After a month of secret gifts and candies, it culminates in a big celebration where you all go out.
Did you leave Colombia before or after this day?
The day before.
Oh my gosh, so like you spent all month giving little gifts and candies to your friends and they're never going to know that it was you because you bolted before this day of international friendship.
They will never know. I will never tell them. They have no clue. So this week, Todd, we're going to talk about why the U.S. is one of the worst democracies in the world at voter turnout, why the American dream is causing depression, and should you buy a house? So I just got back from Colombia. One of the big things happening there, though, is you know, Brexit happened a few months ago, and on the same exact day, Colombia came to a peace agreement with their big drug cartel called the FARC. And now they have a resolution that's going to go to the people, and they have to vote yay or nay. And the interesting thing is, in a lot of South America, voter turnout is high because they're required to vote, unless you're 500 kilometers away from home, and then you sign a document that says that you weren't home, you couldn't vote. But pretty much they're required to. And then in the U.S., it's optional. And our voter turnout's really bad.
Yep. There are countries around the world that do have mandatory voting. Australia is one example. I believe they have the highest voting rate in the world with about 95% voter turnout. But yeah, if you look at the United States, I think we hover around 120th, 130th out of the 169 recognized democracies in the world right now. It depends on whether you go by eligible voters, registered voters, people of voting age. There's a lot of like different ways you can slice it. But
yes.
No matter how you slice it, voter turnout in the United States is truly terrible. On presidential elections, turnout usually hovers around 60%. For our midterm elections, it's maybe around 40%. And then in off-year elections, forget about it. It's down in the low teens and 20s. And depending on where you go, sometimes it's worse than that. The 1999 mayoral election in Dallas had a 5% turnout rate.
5%
of Dallas? It just blows my mind that the participation rate in, you know, the government can be so low.
I will mention that we have way, way better voter turnout than the latest election in Russia for Putin. Only 35% showed up. I mean, come on, we're doing fine. 60% is great.
I don't even know if Russia like counts as a democracy when we're, you know, in this list of 169 democracies. I don't even know if it's recognized as a democracy.
Unimportant. Valid comparison.
We had this very turbulent primary season just in the last few months. How many people in the country do you think participated in the primary elections?
I think on Super Tuesday, approximately 8 million Republicans and 5 million Democrats participated. That is the statistic I am aware of.
Yeah, so that's correct. Percentage-wise, about 29% of the country participated in the primary elections.
Of eligible or
what? Of eligible voters, eligible.
Yeah. I've noticed that registered voters is very, very close to the number of actual voters because the people who actually take the time to register are more likely to vote. But percent of eligible voters is a more interesting indicator.
That's kind of, you're always trying to make up that gap between eligible voters and then actual voters.
Exactly. I'm actually going to jump right to a solution, just one of them. And now I understand why people are always bugging you to register to vote, because I'm going to guess, psychologically speaking, once you're registered, you're much more likely to actually vote. Not only because you've already done the hassle to register and you don't have to think about it, but also now you are reminded that you have to vote and, you know, you went through the action to register, so you probably mentally decided you might actually go vote. So one solution is just to push people to register however you possibly can.
I would say going out and voting is the easy part, right? That just means show up at a place and cast your ballot in most places. Whereas registering, most people who are not registered don't know how to register. So then you've got to go through the process of like figuring out where you have to go to register, what that process looks like. Sometimes it involves getting an ID if you don't have one already. You know, there's a lot of steps involved. And it's just kind of daunting,
right,
for lack of a better word, if you don't know what you're doing.
Which is why the people that are out there are just saying, here, register right now. Here's all you have to do. Fill out this form and you're done. And I've registered to vote in California, I think, that way when I went to a farmer's market. and there was just people registering you. But of the people who are not registered to vote, a third of them say that they have difficulty getting to the polls, and almost half of them say that they're too busy. So it's not just the fact that it's hard to register, but they actually don't anticipate ever actually going to vote, a lot of them.
As in, like, even if they were registered, they don't foresee themselves being able to take the time to go to the polls and vote to begin with?
They don't foresee that, correct. Now, of people who are registered but rarely vote, only 20% say that it's because they can't get to the polls, and 30% say because they're busy. But so the number goes down, I think, psychologically once you register.
Yeah. Well, and then plus also, I imagine you once you're registered, you get things like sample ballots. You're more likely to get correspondence from the various political parties, especially if you register with a political party. They're going to know where you live, and they're going to want to make sure that you turn out to vote. So you're more likely to get reminders about upcoming elections, and so that jogs your memory to go vote.
Mm-hmm. I want to discuss whether you think it's good or bad that we have low voter turnout. You apparently think it's bad, and whether it's good or bad that it's our choice to vote versus making it compulsory.
I will take the position that low voter turnout is a bad thing, and I will talk about my position about mandatory voting later.
Later, okay. My answer is there's good reason not to make it mandatory. Having a lot of people turn out for a vote is important for a few reasons. Number one is just get more people engaged in the country. Number two is make sure the laws are better aligned to what they want. And then number three is legitimacy of the government. How do you make sure that the government in power is pretty much doing what the country wants and is not at the risk of being overthrown? Macro level stability of a country requires legitimacy of the government. And that's, to me, the biggest argument to say getting more people to vote drives that. Then the question is, what percentage of voters, what percentage is kind of like, okay, that's a pretty good number. We have legitimacy in the government. And I mean, you could just take a stab at that. I don't know what the number is. 50%, 70%, 20%.
I agree with you in as much as there isn't like a magic number, like the fact that we only have, you know, whatever 60% participation in the presidential elections, you know, that's neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned. Again, I get a little concerned when we look at other democracies around the world and see how low we are compared to them. But, you know, the United States is a different country than these other countries. And so maybe there's something specific. But we're aware of disparities in the voting participation rate of these various groups, right? Like, we know that the elderly vote disproportionately to the young. We know that whites and blacks vote disproportionately higher than Latinos and Asians. Like, we know that the wealthy vote disproportionately to the working class. Like,
clearly, yeah.
We know that those things exist. And so we can only expect that the policies that the people that we elect will reflect those disparities. And I think that's bad for society.
I don't know that the legislature will specifically aim their policies towards the policy preferences of people who voted versus the policy preferences of the whole populace, given the mechanisms we know that lobbying and special interests drive a lot of legislature and a lot of policy, but are not necessarily proportionally represented by the voting populace. I don't think fixing voter turnout will fix the fact that the legislature is not legislating to the whole country.
I see what you're saying. So let's say, let's take the elderly population, you know, represented by lobbying groups like the AARP and others that clearly are, you know, in favor of Social Security and, you know, those kinds of programs. Mm-hmm. You're saying even if somehow young people voted in equal numbers to the elderly, the strength of the AARP lobby would be unchanged by the fact that that you still had young people voting. And so like the voice of the elderly lobby would still be louder than the voice of the young lobby.
The latter point, I would say, summarizes it well. I wouldn't say that there would be no impact, but the larger force in a physics free body diagram is coming from this smaller group of people that have more power. Yeah. I think that's fairly well understood mechanism of how our great democracy works.
I feel like if you had more young people actively interested in voting, they would create more lobbying groups that were specifically advocating for their positions.
So down the line, yes, like they have the potential to create these larger forces. They just don't have them yet. So purely based on voter turnout, the number of voters in that age bracket is maybe pushes the needle a little bit, but having stronger organized groups that create real consequence to the legislature for not satisfying their needs, that does a much better job. You know, like I said, there's three reasons to get more people to vote. One is that so they're more engaged. Two is that their opinion is actually incorporated. And then three, the legitimacy of the government. Mm-hmm. If we want their opinion to be incorporated, the number two, it's just the better I understand how my vote is going to impact me, my community, the whole country, the better job I can do in voting what I actually think. You know, one of the big problems we have across the board is that a lot of us don't necessarily know that because laws are complicated, because we're hearing a lot of lies from both sides and we have to filter through all that. Mm-hmm. So the better any of us are engaged in understanding what's going on, the more closely tied our vote is to what we actually want. And the more we have that, then the more people voting, the better. My concern is pulling people in who, if they're already not registered, and if not because they can't or they don't have time, but if they're not registered because that 55% who just don't have interest in local politics, then part of the strategy to pull people in should also be to make sure it's for the right reasons.
Yeah. And that's why, I mean, if we want to start moving into some of the solutions there, like, I mean, one of the ones that you could immediately say is if you want more voting, make it illegal to not vote, force everyone to vote. And obviously that conflicts with principles of individual freedom and things like that. And you sort of have to measure that up against, you know, what benefits you're trying to get from increased voter turnout.
Also true. For instance, you have Argentina, mandatory voting and huge amounts of bought votes. I've heard personal accounts of somebody 1 degree away working at the polls and seeing this actually happen very blatantly. So one consequence of people who aren't interested, don't have an opinion, forced to vote is, for instance, it's more open to corruption.
I've never been able to come down one way or another on this point. Like, I agree with you that you open it up to more corruption. You're also more likely to get people who just sort of vote randomly or vote for the top name on the ticket, whatever that happens to be, so they can just get in and get out and get it over with. You know, it's going to happen. And it's, you know, one of the downsides to mandatory voting. How much of that happens, I think, is difficult to quantify.
Mm-hmm. It's hard.
That's why I can't really say one way or the other which way I come down on that.
I will say that as a person who travels a lot and doesn't really understand the mechanics of absentee voting, I probably won't even vote this cycle.
In the presidential election?
Yeah.
I can point you to a very good YouTube video series that talks about how to vote in every single state, how to register, and what to do if you want to vote absentee.
I don't even know what state I'm a resident of. When I was doing my healthcare, I was going through all the Obamacare websites, all of the marketplaces for all these three different states that might or may not claim me as a citizen of their state. I get why some people don't vote, because it's just a pain. Plus, this time it really doesn't matter what I vote, because all three states are very, very clearly one color.
No, there's more than just the presidential. There's all the local elections, too.
Listen to me.
If you're in Massachusetts, right? Like, Massachusetts is most likely going to vote Democratic for president, but they have, I'm told, a very popular Republican governor right now. So it's possible to split your ticket.
I'm embarrassed to say that I am technically a Massachusetts resident and did not know that we have a Republican governor.
I think he's the most popular governor in the country right now, in fact.
Well, it's a good state. Yeah. You know, things are going pretty well.
Yeah. So I'll include the link to that for anyone listening to our show who's interested enough to listen to a show about politics and current events, but is somehow not registered for vote. We'll put that in the link for you so you can
like
make sure
me.
You're signed up.
So
forget
awful.
Listening to the show, making the show.
Yeah, it's more important to make a show than follow my own advice, right?
Yeah. No, I totally understand. Like, I mean, given all the travel that you do, and at this point, I don't even know if you know where you're going to be on election day, so.
I know where I will be the Saturday after election day. Tell you later.
I look forward to it. But yeah, so I guess other solutions, yeah, mandatory voting would not be at the top of my list. I think the one that's shown the greatest promise in the places where it was implemented is to have election day registration and voting, so you can show up and vote at the same time. So that eliminates the hurdle of having to register prior to voting. And you see anywhere from like a 5 to 6% increase in voter participation rate in states where this is implemented.
All right. And if people are wondering, I don't know, nobody wonders, it's a pretty obvious point. What I've learned from working in defense and dealing with government is things that seem evil or slow for no reason, it really just boils down to people being constrained with what they can actually do in their jobs and just a lot of paperwork and people not having all the information to make a better decision because things are so bureaucratized. So why does that not already happen? Why don't we have voter registration at the polling area? It's probably just a matter of the process it takes to register somebody needs the back office and needs time and needs paperwork. And it's not, everything's not digitized yet. It's not all in the IT systems. I mean, hopefully that'll happen eventually, but it's not just a turnkey, easy thing to do because a bloated, stovepiped, complicated government system has to approve each person that applies and prove that they're a real person and not registering 10 times the same day in different locations and all that stuff.
I will say that while that is a contributing factor, there are also political
factors. You're going to say political reasons.
I am going to.
I totally disagree.
You don't think the fact that same-day registration does benefit one party over another doesn't have an impact?
I don't think that individual congressmen are saying, I'm opposed to same-day voter registration because it's going to hurt my chances of re-election. You think people are thinking that?
I do think people are thinking that. And I think you can look at every state that has attempted to implement stricter voter ID or more difficult voting hours or things like that, you can tie it directly to political party.
And almost always, there is a parallel story that also makes sense in that situation, such as reduction of voter fraud. And yes, you should have an ID when you vote. And how ridiculous is it that they don't ask for an ID?
I think we disagree here.
I have one more important point. Every country has its own equilibrium of participation. It's dependent on a lot of factors, dependent on their jobs, dependent on the feedback system that they're feeling from the legislature. So, you know, it'd be good for us to push the number higher than it's currently. And it would be good for us to improve how well-informed people are when they're voting rather than, like you said, just randomly picking the top name just to get out of there or whatnot. So forcing someone to go, not a great idea because someone will just pick the top one or they may be more susceptible to have their vote bought. But anything that we can do to, I guess, convince people that it's valuable and to invest a little bit of time in it.
You like to talk about cultural solutions. That if we just had more of a cultural emphasis on participating in an election, that like this was something that you did, that everyone got together, you got together with your friends or your family, you like went over the election ballot, you discussed it like over the dinner table, you know, you talked about the kinds of things that were important to you. And you like, you know, like you're talking about, like having be more informed, like getting the perspectives of your friends and your family about the issues. And then, you know, there's just more of a cultural expectation that you participate in the elections.
Yep.
That would, you know, hit both the being informed and also the participation level. Like, I think that's a big deal, while also removing the structural barriers to voting, which are certainly out there.
When I lived in California, every year, my cousin would have a proposition party. In California, every year, there's usually propositions on the ballot that any Californian can write and create a law that would go into the law books with enough signatures and then enough votes during the elections. 10 of us would get together, so we would each pick one, study it, and present both sides to the group. And so you only have to invest time to learn one really well, and then all 10 people cover all the propositions, and then you come out of the party with a pretty good idea of what you should do or shouldn't vote for. Super fun. I encourage everyone to do it. So you're saying something about changing the culture of the U.S., huh? To vote.
Yeah.
Have I ever told you that there are things about the culture of the U.S. that I dislike a little bit?
I think from your worldly travels, you've been exposed to other cultures and been able to see the different ways that people do things around the world and contrast that against the way we do things here. And you have some opinions on that.
No opinions ever. So a lot of articles and like Facebook postings about depression for some reason have been popping up in the last couple of weeks. And I was in Colombia at the time and I'm just realizing, hey, you know what? I'm not really depressed here. And I used to kind of, in the U.S., go through phases up and down. Why am I not feeling depression and not relating to this anymore? So I thought of three things, which are relevant. One is that I was far less stressed with my work and job the way I've changed my work life. Two is I've had a lot more flexibility to go do what I want and do what I need, have more free time, also as a result of the change of my job situation. And then three is that Colombia is like a culture of hugging and touching and close relationships and prioritizing people over having perfect efficiency of your time over the day. My hypothesis is that the way that the U.S. and some of the other Western countries have industrialized and created this super, super highly productive workforce and economic engine, the way we have this American dream, which is sort of a set of ideals in which freedom includes the opportunity for prosperity and success and upward social mobility, all of that's kind of focused on improving yourself financially, which requires working hard. And this individualism and individualistic success that American emphasizes, I think, creates this other culture that de-emphasizes the relationships and the social interconnectedness and the free time you spend and results in depression, is my theory.
Let's see. So
I have some data to back this up.
I'm sure you do.
Some of which is inconclusive. A lot of which I plotted on maps.
Oh, yeah. I love your maps. Your maps are great. I guess I just wanted to sort of state at the onset here that depression is an incredibly complicated topic. There are an enormous number of potential causes from biological to environmental to social. I have practiced reading academic papers, and as I was going through some of these things, you know, they use these kinds of weasel words, isn't the right thing, but like when they're not sure about something, they'll say, but we have all these other confounding, you know, factors that influence the data. They clearly feel like there's a lot going on here and potentially things that they don't understand yet. So I guess with this giant caveat, depression is complicated. I think we can move on.
It's complicated. Having had a lot of experience with it, both from personal experience and reading about it and studying and talking to a lot of people, it's generally a feeling of social isolation or overwhelmingness that triggers it, and that gets perpetuated by further social isolation because you have this tendency to withdraw and not do the things that would help you normally to get through problems. So for instance, if you have a loving family and one day you have a problem at work and your boss yells at you or fires you and you have a very tough day, you have people at home. Later you go home too and you talk to about it. Versus if you live by yourself, don't have any friends or family, boss fires you, you go home, you don't have anybody to support you. I mean, obviously, having a social structure is a basic method to rebound from a difficult situation.
I totally agree that having a strong social community to fall back on is a buffer against depression.
I would say the lack thereof is a cause of it, as opposed to think of it as a remedy or a buffer. And there's an anti-correlation between the efficiency and economic prosperity of a country and its degree of social interaction.
I'll say it's a general correlation or anti-correlation, but not it's not an ironclad rule, with Japan being a good counterexample.
I spent about 10 hours digging into data to try to prove this point, and obviously this is a longer research thesis to say that our own culture of success is the cause of a lot of depression in this country. I can't prove it yet, but I'm going to stand by that statement and I'm going to throw maps at you.
Okay.
And show you that's somewhat true.
So let's accept your thesis that a more socially connected society should see lower rates of depression. What do your maps tell us?
So I should point out first that according to WHO Mental Health Survey Initiative, and they surveyed 90,000 people in 18 countries for this study, the US and France are the two most depressive countries. The U.S. has reported 19% of its people have had a major depressive episode. So I should first establish that, yes, the U.S. is suffering one of the highest rates of depression, according to the survey. So first, when we were thinking about why is the U.S. so depressed, I was thinking, well, it could be wealth, it could be inequality, or it could be something cultural, right? So we made one map that's the PPP, adjusted GDP per capita. Purchasing power parity, which is just to say, is trying to say apples to apples, GDP per person comparison across countries. Second one for inequality, I use the Gini index, which is a measure of inequality that's pretty standardized in economics. And to compare this to levels of depression, we looked at two different things. One of them is prevalence of diagnosed clinical depression. The problem with this map is it's going to be slightly biased or skewed by each individual country's culture of people going to clinics and how likely they are to diagnose you. So I take that map with a huge grain of salt.
This goes back to our giant caveat that even diagnosing this is very tricky. Like getting good quantitative data on depression, so hard.
Which is why I looked to suicides. So we also found data for suicide rates per 100,000 people. I don't know why I like to cite this statistic, but Lithuania, my homeland, is one of the top rates of suicide, unfortunately. You'll see it in the map. It's a big dark green in the middle of lighter green Eastern Europe.
Is that Lithuania? I saw it, like, man, what's going on there?
Yeah, very unfortunate. So we look at these maps and we'll put links to them too so you can play around. So generally all these maps are color-coded. So the lighter green is better and darker green is worse. Mm-hmm. So good GDP per capita will be very, very light and lower suicide rate will be very, very light.
As I was flipping through these maps and like toggling back and forth between, you know, suicide rate and GDP or suicide rate and inequality, it's kind of inconclusive, right? Like, I mean, you can certainly highlight examples of places where the GDP and the depression rate are correlated, like you said, in the United States. But I mean, there are also outliers like Japan, which has a very high GDP as well, but also a very low rate of depression.
Right.
And you can sort of try and figure out why that is. Like in Japan, I know that they have a more communal culture than we do, and they also have a much lower inequality rate than the United States does. So, right. You know, there could be some contributing factors there.
That's what I'm thinking. And, you know, I did plot the GDP per capita versus the suicide rate and did a quick regression. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you just look at the data, GDP per capita of about 50,000 or higher the suicide rate caps at 10 per 100,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it only goes above that for lower incomes. So there's some data to say that actually higher GDP is better. Peeling this apart is very complicated. But I personally think that points to the fact that it's cultural. Like, I think income is the wrong thing to look at when we're trying to pull apart what depression is. It's just that sometimes the income levels will impact the culture itself that we're talking about.
It's a shame we can't come up with, like, I wonder if there is, if some, you know, sociologist or anthropologist has gone through and tried to come up with a quantitative measure for this sort of social community strength that you're talking about. Like, you say that it's stronger in Colombia versus America. And, like, it would be really great to add to this analysis if there was a way to measure that. And I don't know how you would do that. You know, maybe count number of friends or number of people who live close to their family, something. You could figure it out. So, okay. So let's accept that America has built its economic prosperity on the backs of social isolation and such, and that we're paying the price in our society by our high depression rates. Like, I mean, is it something we try to fix?
Love each other more. Hug each other. Let's hug strangers. Let's say hi to each other on the streets. It's not just a big city thing where people don't look at each other because there's a million people and it's overwhelming. New York City and Chicago. No. Medellin is 4 million people, and there everyone looks at each other and says hello. It's possible, guys.
So we should all carry around a sign that says free hugs.
A stamp on your forehead that says hug me. I'm just going to keep being Colombian and hug people when I see them on the streets and give them a kiss on the cheek. I did that the other day.
In America?
In America.
With a person you didn't know?
I went and saw my friend play guitar in a band at Shaw's Oyster Restaurant in Chicago the other day. Mm-hmm. And it turns out some of the guys that were in the band were still there. So I started chatting with one of them. Turns out he's won a Grammy before. What? Super nice guy. And then I go outside. We're waiting for the valet for my friend's car. And then the guy that was playing bass is out there. He travels the world a lot too. And we're both talking about the fact that, oh, you know, we come back to the U.S., suddenly people just don't look at you and they don't smile and it just feels so, ah. So he and I both related to that. And so then towards the end of the discussion, I lean in, I give him a hug and I kiss his cheek and he just has this look on his face. Like, oh my God. And then he's like holding my hands and he's a really friendly guy. I really like him. Turns out he used to play with Miles Davis. Oh my God.
My goodness.
Oh my goodness.
How do you find these people? This doesn't happen to me. I don't run into people who are Grammy Award winning artists.
Look up Brian Burke. That's the friend. He's going to start listening to our podcast too. He promised.
Just as long as he tells all of his friends and announces it in every one of his shows at the end.
That's true. I should plug the Matt Stedman Band. There you go. Brian, you better listen to this.
So the American dream is what? A house, 2.4 kids, a car in the garage, nice job, all that stuff, right? Key part of it being a house. So currently, I'm living in a house. You are not living in a house.
I am sitting in a house.
You're sitting in a house, but I will say you have no desire for home ownership. Would that be accurate?
I almost bought a home in 2004 when all my friends were graduating college and buying a home because the prices were going up and it sounded like a good idea.
Thank you, real estate bubble.
Yeah. No, I don't. I realized at the time, even if I rented it out after I moved, it would just tie me to one city for at least 5 years before the payback becomes reasonable under some calculation with some risk. And like, I don't want to commit to being in one place for more than 5 days. 5 years? What?
So it's a legitimate question to raise in this day and age as to whether the American dream should still include owning your own home.
It is a legitimate question, not just for me. As I found out, other people have similar concerns. There's financial considerations and general life risk and commitment and a bunch of reasons that other people may decide not to have a home either.
Yeah, I think one of the common reasons that gets trotted out is that it's, you know, it's a good investment to have in your own home, right? Like that you're not throwing money away on rent every month. You're, you know, building equity in your own home. And I can say from experience that while that may be true farther down the line, I don't know what fraction of the mortgage payment I currently make goes to the principal of the loan, but I can tell you it's not very large. More broadly, like real estate, you know, offers maybe a 1.5% annual return aggregated around the country. So it's not very good compared to what something like the stock market would offer.
Although, I mean, you're highly leveraging your money. So we buy a house for $1 million. We put down 20%, which is 200,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now on the 800,000, let's say we're paying 4%. We're paying 4% per year on 800,000.
On a 30-year note, sure.
So that would be $32,000 1 year that we're paying. right?
4% of 800,000. Yep, 32,000.
Now, let's say that the value of the house goes up by 1.5% that first year. So it goes from 1 million to 1,015,000.
Mm-hmm.
We've gained $15,000 value of equity, but we've paid $32,000 in interest.
Mm-hmm.
So there we go. So I lost money that year. So, you know, it could be that it grows more than 1.5% per year. I don't know what's average for the house market.
I think 1.5% is sort of long-term average. There's obviously spikes and valleys from various events throughout history. But like if you're in it for the long haul, I guess, like that's what you can expect.
So then we can also say, fine, you lost $17,000 this year, but all that rent you would have paid, you didn't lose.
Yeah.
So in effect, you didn't lose the, let's say, I don't know, $1,500 a month rent that you had been paying, which is what, $18,000.
Yep.
So now you haven't lost $18,000, but you've lost $70,000. So now you're net up $1,000. But then you probably had to pay for maintenance stuff that you would normally wouldn't have had to pay, plus homeowners, blah, blah, blah.
Ah, yes. What have we had to replace in this house in the last 5 years? We've needed a new boiler. We've had to paint the house.
Because, Todd, you're seriously here going to convince me whether or not I should ever buy a house. Like, I'm really in the long-term maybe camp. So this is very important discussion right now.
Well, so if you're talking from a financial perspective, I'm going to just tell you right now, it's a terrible idea.
Really?
The reasons why you buy a house should not be financial.
Have you spent more money on your baby or on the house?
I mean, so far?
Yeah.
I don't actually know the answer to that question.
Yeah, okay.
It's a good,
comparable.
It's a good question. It's probably order of magnitude the same.
House is an expensive baby.
But here, do you want me to talk about like the good things you get from a house? Here's what I can say. So let's tie this back to our previous topic about social isolation and depression.
Ooh.
I can think of no stronger bond that I've formed within my community than I have with my neighbors.
Hmm.
So owning a house is a very good opportunity to forge some very strong ties with the people that you live with, to get to know them and their families and their children, and to hear about the things going on in their lives, and to have them available to you if you have something going on in your life.
Because you all know that nobody's going anywhere. So you're going to invest the time to know each other, of course.
It's kind of true, but not really. I mean, I see what you're saying, that like if you're going to be living next door to these people for the next 20 years, you better be on your best behavior. I mean, that shouldn't be the thing that motivates you being nice to your neighbors, but it is a factor.
Hi, Todd's neighbors.
No, that's not the reason why I'm nice to all my neighbors. They are actually genuinely great people.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, that also tampers bad behavior in a lot of ways.
For the social aspect, like you're saying, for depression, on the other hand, if you like quantity people, when you rent, you're much more likely to be in an apartment building situation. So the density of people, the number of people you meet will be much greater.
Do you find that you forge strong ties with people in your apartment complexes?
Did not say strong ties.
Okay.
Just said a quantity of people.
I was just curious. I wasn't sure. I personally never really talked to a lot of the people that I shared apartments with. That might just be my social personality.
I always imagined I would live in New York in a tall apartment building and go down the fire escape to my neighbor's place and hang out all the time like they do in the show Friends. Hasn't really been true.
Yeah, they just crossed the hall, man.
Like, I made a really good friend that lives in my apartment building back when I lived in Chicago, but I met him through a friend of a friend, and then later we discovered we lived in the same building. So we didn't become friends because we were living in the same building. So yeah, I think you're true there.
As far as like putting down roots in the community, right? Like, you're more likely to get involved in local politics or the school district or community, you know, community organizations. Like, you're more likely to have those long-term friendships or ties to the community, which can be a strong source of happiness.
Okay. Maybe.
If you like decorating,
like
the fact that you can alter the appearance of the inside and outside of your dwelling in a way that you see fit and not feel constrained by the rules that your landlord enforces.
I do like that. I think I would like to have a duplex, rent one of them, and then not live in the other one. But those times I do come back to the U.S., have a place where I could stay. That would be half my community. That would be perfect. But life is much more adventurous if you don't have a house, right?
Life is much more adventurous if you don't have a house. Depends on what your idea of adventure is.
Finding roommates, moving, meeting new neighbors, exploring new neighborhoods, gaining new experiences and perspectives. That's life.
That is an aspect of life.
That's a life.
That is a life, for sure. But you're saying you get to meet lots of people. And I guess I would say, do you really meet those people, or do you just like have encounters with lots of people? Like, do you really get to know any of these people?
In 6 months, in a foreign country, I got to know a number of people very well mm-hmm. that are now close friends. Mm-hmm. And that was only 6 months.
I'm going to save this for season two of the show. I'm going to come back and ask you how many of those people you still have close ties with.
That is an awful thing to accuse me of.
I'm not. No. I'm curious what the answer will be. I really hope the answer is that you talk to all of them.
The answer, I have no, all of them. No, that's too many. But at least much, at least 10.
The average number of people that Dynasty is in contact with. I don't know. Whatever metric you want to use.
Okay. Friends I made in Dubai, living in Dubai for 6 months. In fact, living there for half of 6 months or less than half because most of the time I was in Saudi Arabia. I'm now going to the wedding of one of them. Actually, I knew her in business school. But with a group of friends that I met there.
Okay. Maybe.
Should I chime in on some of my negatives and you can just add them to the list or counter them?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. There's opportunity cost, which is difficult to quantify. Like I mm-hmm. could have taken that big lump of money and started a business or traveled the world for a couple of years or bailed my friend out of jail. I mean, lots of potential uses there.
Mm-hmm.
You did hear when I said bail your friend out of jail, right?
I did hear bail your friend out of jail. Do you have a lot of friends who end up in jail?
I don't think so. Okay. Not yet.
I know for sure you would help them out of jail if they needed it.
Absolutely.
So yeah, opportunity cost. Yep.
Opportunity cost. Commitment. This is a good question. What if you get it wrong? You do all your research, you pick the house, you move in, and it's the wrong school district. You can't deal with your neighbors. The culture changes in a couple years. You don't have flexibility or a new job that, you know, you get fired a month later and you have to now work across the city. All these things. This can introduce huge inconveniences to your life and drastically affect, you know, your happiness, your kids' future.
Mm-hmm.
With a house, you don't have this flexibility.
Yeah. Like assuming it's roughly financially flat, which is questionable. If you need to move from one house to another house, like, yeah, it's a hassle, but no more of a hassle than it is moving from one apartment to another.
Well, transaction costs, the time it takes to sell it, paperwork, money.
True.
It doesn't cost that much to move if you're renting.
It gets offset a little bit if, like, I mean, sort of like what you were saying earlier, like if you're making at least a little bit of money off the appreciation value of your house, then. But no, I mean, I'm not going to really strongly argue against this. You're correct.
Practically speaking, most people will not end up moving if one of these events happens and they live in a house. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to move if they were renting, right?
They're more likely to move if they're rent because the transaction costs are lower. That's correct.
Right. So it's potentially a higher risk to your happiness in life if you buy a house.
Mm-hmm.
The American dream was not always equal to owning a house. That was a political ploy. It's a marketing ploy to try to increase the GDP by creating more demand. And people started listening to this and like, yeah. We all should have homes. We should own homes. That's equivalent to the American dream. And so they pushed home sales up. Well, sometime later, there was a financial crash. Financial crash was in part because of the oversales of homes. It's because of the American dream.
Which financial crash are we referring to here?
2007. Okay. Subprime mortgages, homes purchased by people.
I really, really do not want to get into the details of that particular incident in the X minutes that we have left on this program. I hear what you're saying.
It was obviously not the only cause, but it is the set of loans that were not appropriately risk adjusted or monitored were related to buying houses. I'm just throwing that out there.
That is true. We can talk another time about who was responsible for that.
I'm not saying responsible. I'm just saying American dream, buy a home. I'm just needling.
I know. We can talk about the financial crisis sometime.
And did you know that since the middle of the 20th century, U.S. home ownership rate has fluctuated between 62 and 70%?
I did not know that.
That's very high.
That's a fairly narrow range.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, it comes back to like, other reasons why. I mean, if you want, I don't know, if you have expansive hobbies, you know, things that you need a lot of space for, or you like to have if you have pets, if you like to have a yard for your pets.
You can rent a house.
I mean, like, when I saw this topic, I'm like, I'm not going to come down either way on whether you should have a house or not. Like, it's totally up to, you know, your individual circumstances and whether you are in a place in your life where that makes sense. If someone doesn't want to own a home for all the reasons you're describing, you know, I'm not going to come down on that. It makes sense.
I honestly think it would be very fascinating to build your own, to kind of build and design your own home. I think that would be a fun art project.
I don't spend a lot of time on interior decoration. I'm perfectly happy to leave that to someone who knows what they're doing. I mean, like, does it have a roof? Does it have some rooms? Is it warm in the winter and cold in the summer? Okay, I'm good.
It's time for our Trump date.
What's the amusing thing I've seen recently is that Trump's surge in the polls is likely motivating more people to go out and vote, since him becoming president is looking more likely as a reality, and it's scaring the crap out of people.
Why did we not have this as a solution earlier? A colorful candidate on one party, bring out the vote to the other party.
We were talking about polling and the value of polling. And I was thinking about polling sort of like if you had a system for like beating the stock market, right? Like if you knew that on the first Thursday of every month, this category of stocks was overvalued or undervalued, and you could make money reliably by finding some wrinkle in the system that's no one else knows about. Well, like as soon as everyone knows about it, that little thing goes away. And I think polling is sort of the same, right? Like when you take a poll and you find out, oh gosh, look, Donald Trump is 5 points up and is, if you held the election today, he would win the presidency. Well, that has an effect, right? It's like that impacts the current system. It means that like, oh, more people are going to vote or not vote, you know, depending on that. Like they see that polling information like, oh, is that the likely outcome? I should change my behavior accordingly.
Mm-hmm. There's some sort of restoring force that when the pendulum of favorability swings one direction, there's a pull to bring it back to the middle,
right,
by encouraging more people to care. The degree at which people care and get vocal is inversely proportional to their candidate's popularity, potentially.
Yeah, I agree. It can go both ways too, right? Like if someone's down 15 points, you know, in a poll, like if it's going to be a blowout, then the opposing side like, oh, maybe I don't even need to really go out and vote because it's going to be a blowout anyway and it doesn't really matter. Like you can, it has the effect of either depressing or, you know, increasing participation based on how close things are.
I just find it fascinating that Trump is trying to take very precise measures to increase his African-American popularity from 0% to something greater than 0%.
I can tell you that calling for stop and frisk throughout the urban communities in the country is not going to get him that way.
Are you sure? Maybe it'll have the opposite effect, like you just said.
Well, you can't really go below zero, so it doesn't hurt.
That's what his campaign is, too. It can't get any worse. Vote for me. That's what he's saying.
Oh, gosh. Yes, that's true. I mean, I'm watching the numbers. I think I'm seeing the same things. It's like, oh, he's getting nervously closer. And I really hope that there's this backlash effect. We're like, oh, hey, guys, yeah, we really do need to actually like finish this election and make sure that this guy does not end up our president.
My sources in Washington say that his likelihood of success has increased in the past couple of months. Still, electoral college-wise, the path to presidency is going to be difficult. In other words, the swing states he has to capture versus we're only talking about national polls. But it's more likely than it was before.
I think I found a better way. Like instead of me giving you a percentage chance of like what I think is going to happen.
Because you're nervous.
Yeah. Here's my new replacement. I have a button like right here on the desk next to me that says, hold election tomorrow. Do not hold election tomorrow. And you can ask me whether I would push that button or not.
Would you push that button today?
Today I would push that button.
Hold election tomorrow.
Hold election tomorrow. I'm confident in the result.
I would love to hold election tomorrow because then I could actually go vote. Except I have to go back to Massachusetts. How about on Tuesday when I'm in Boston? Yeah.
Oh, we didn't even talk about that when we were talking about the voting thing. I was going to say one of the things you can do to improve voter participation is to get the election off of a Tuesday. Why do we still have it on a Tuesday?
Do you know, in Argentina, elections are on Sundays. And then the night before elections, the bars are not allowed to be open. And stores cannot sell liquor after like 5 p.m.
I find that hilarious. In most of the other democracies around the world, Election Day is on a weekend or Election Day is a national holiday. Most people don't work that day.
Yeah, that's ridiculous to make it on a work day. Like, why? Should be a national holiday. Yeah.
Well, they do it in November, so it's after the harvest, and they do it on a Tuesday so that you can go to church on Sunday, leave, go vote, and then get back in time for the next Sunday so you don't miss church.
Oh, because you might have to go to another city in order to vote.
It may take you a day or more of travel to get
there,
yeah.
Right. Do you think Trump is happy? Happy person or not?
Do I think Trump is happy? I don't know.
Yeah.
I hear these things that, like, he doesn't even really want to be president. He's sort of, like, discouraged by how well these things have been going.
I have heard that rumor lately. I hear he wants to start a news station.
Great. Just what we need. Another one of these things. Another Fox News. No, thank you. No, thank you.
How about another Daily Show, but on the right side? That would be funny.
Why is there no conservative answer to the Daily Show?
It is just integrated with the real news.
That's sort of my answer. But, like, I'm genuinely curious. Like, if there is truly, like, equal accountability, equal blame on both sides for, like, the ridiculous things that these people do, why isn't there a conservative version of the Daily Show that lampoons all the things that Democrats do?
I'm starting to believe that most economic models are so severely flawed that some of the conclusions that we make by taking basic supply-demand arguments really don't apply. So I will say, just because there's a demand and opportunity for such a show, it doesn't mean that the circumstances or personalities exist to support such a show with a different set of listeners.
You're saying, like, the quote-unquote Hollywood industry is, to use the word, biased.
A little different. To simplify this into a supply and demand economic argument is to ignore the fact that Republicans will probably not want to do the same things that Democrats are doing. Or it could be that they don't have the same humor. I mean, there could be a lot of characteristics about them. I don't have a good answer, but I'm pushing against that. Just because there's a demand doesn't mean that there will be a solution automatically filled in.
I don't have a good answer either. I queue up on asymmetries and I'm like, that's odd. I wonder why.
No, it is odd.
So maybe we'll talk about that on a future episode of Maximize This. For now, thanks for listening to our show today. We're proud to announce that we now have a Facebook page that we will be using to post our shows as well as host discussions for the various episodes. So you can use that going forward. It's at facebook.com/maximizethis. We also still have our discussion page on Reddit as well at reddit.com/r/maximizethis. So feel free to use those to add your perspective. Let us know if you have any ideas for future topics.
And you can also check out our website at www.maximizethis.fm. Keep an eye out for news, new episodes, bonus features, and tell your friends and spread the word about how much you love our show.
And don't forget to leave a rating and a review on iTunes. I can't think of anything else that increases the visibility of our show and spreads the word about the stuff that we're talking about. So it's a huge help.
Thanks, guys. And until next time, don't let pretty good be the enemy of perfect. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Interrupting cow.
Interrupting cow.
Moo!
Oh, I even saw that one coming.